You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We are going to jump right into this interview. We have a very special guest, singer, songwriter, and guitarist extraordinaire, Marcus Eaton. Marcus, how are you?
Yo, man, I'm so happy to be here, and I'm happy that this worked.
Yes, and you know what? There's always glitches. There's, you know, with anything creative, there's, you know this. There are always glitches, and this is why artists and musicians, we all die young.
That's right.
So you just flew in from Italy. Let's talk about that real quick. You've been spending some time in the mountains of Italy.
This trip was, first off, I mean, I'm actually a dual citizen there now, which is really exciting. I spent a lot of time there, and I started going there in 2012 and touring. So that's all of this spawned from that. And I have this wonderful guitar that was made for me, and it's called a McAllister. And basically, when I was playing with Crosby, he gave this to me as a gift, introduced me to this guy, Roy. And Roy was like, I go to Italy every year and I'd love to have you go with me. And I was like, man, I'd love to go. So that was in 2012. So he took me with him and I played. I mean, I can go off on this scenario, but I'll just do the Cliff Note version. But basically, I played in a castle, and the castle was full of luthiers. Every room in the castle had a different guitar maker. Yeah, it's the only thing in the world that I've ever heard of like this.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so I played in the courtyard of the castle, and this castle was basically one of the vacation homes of the Medici family, you know, that ruled Florence. Yep. So it's just this beautiful, beautiful castle in a town called Sarzana. So Roy taught a course on guitar making, and all these young people came. There were like probably 30 students. Two of the students that came in were these students that I made friends with, and their last name is Guarnieri in straight English, Guarnieri. It's kind of an interesting last name. So anyway, I met them in 2012. We became friends. And we started kind of just talking about like, oh, it would be cool to build a guitar that had this and then this and then this. So like we started talking about this years ago, 5 years ago. And about 2 years ago, we got serious. We're like, okay, we're going to do this. So we built, and I helped them design this guitar, and they built this beautiful guitar that I have.
That's amazing.
So part of the trip was picking this guitar up. And then the other part was kind of a mini vacation and then testing it out, touring. And I did about 5 or 6 dates, and I got to kind of figure out what this thing can do. And it's insane. It's absolutely crazy.
Let's go by the woods. What are the woods on the?
Okay. Well, the woods, this is called mango, and it's a stunning wood. It's very similar to mahogany, and back and sides are mango. This is all handmade.
Wow.
Like, and the couple, by the way, it's a husband and wife, which is really cool. So it's like, you know, it's got a feather inlaid.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, I have this background with birds of prey, you know. So then it's got a 5-piece neck. You can see the stripe in there.
Yeah.
So the stripe is one piece of ebony, you know, sandwiched between 2 pieces of maple.
Now, well, what's the significance for that? What does that do?
It stiffens the neck so that it's just really much more stable. Basically, you know, you're not going to experience any neck warps or anything like that. And then the craziness begins. There's 3 pickups in this thing. So you got an acoustic setup. So you have the transducer, you have a mic, and this system is literally so good that I plugged it in to my recording gear just with the mic, and I couldn't tell that it wasn't mic'd. So it opens up all these new possibilities. And then if you look through, it's got this amazing sound port, this hole here. And this hole takes out some of the body compression so you don't get the woofiness when you're recording.
Yeah.
But there's a cable in there, and there's a hidden electric pickup right here. So this is a stereo output. You can run one side into an electric amp. And it's insane. Yeah. Yep.
That's wild.
It's got stainless steel frets. It's a 13 fret. Instead of a 14 fret.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, the scale looks a little bit longer than usual, but how did you decide you wanted 13 frets?
Well, so a normal Martin scale is 14, right? So it's 14 frets to the body. And what happens is on a guitar, like on a regular classical guitar is 12 frets. And if you notice, like when you look at a classical, the bridge is in the middle of the body.
Right.
Really far down. And that's really what creates a lot of volume. I mean, it makes them really loud because it's like a speaker, you know? So we did a 13 to experiment to see if we shifted everything down. It's been done before, but not really in a way, you know, it's very uncommon. So everything shifted. So the hole is shifted down. There's a little more wood here, like on this side. So this thing is just a cannon, man. It sounds, it's crazy. Like, it's just everything.
You got the craziest cool. chops. I love it, man. You got the craziest chops.
Thanks, man. But what's also cool, they routed out two sections here. So it has the truss rod, and then there's two sections that are routed out on either side of the truss rod, and they put carbon fiber in the neck as well.
What?
And the carbon fiber is, yeah, the carbon fiber is lighter than wood. So it translates quicker. So, and the nut right here sits right on top of those two pieces. So it's really crazy because when you play this thing, you have this, which is projecting a bunch of sound back to you. You can hear yourself really well. And everything you play is almost instantaneous. So it's kind of like, holy shit, you know, it's wild.
It sounds like it's fast. It sounds like it's
very fast. Absolutely. Yeah. Everything you play, I mean, it's like the perfect translation tool, basically. So
now I had a custom guitar made for me by James Goodall. And his
son. Oh yeah, he's great. Well,
but you know what? It doesn't make me want to tour with it now that it's like it's so cherry. Oh, it yes. doesn't make me want like so. I record with it, and now I'm like, there's no way I'm taking this on a plane. There's no way, unless it's like a bus tour where I know it'll always be by my side. That thing is going to be recorded because I just don't feel comfortable with how anybody else would handle it. You know what I mean?
I hear you, man.
Or just like leaving it in a green room. That I know you feel the same way.
I don't leave my guitar anywhere. I mean, it's crazy, but I just like when I'm touring, especially overseas, I mean, it's with me. If I go to a restaurant, I take it with me because I'm just not going to leave it anywhere, you know, but you have to have a really good case, of course,
right?
Like carbon fiber cases, but that's kind of another thing with this guitar. There are two models. So there are two prototypes. There's a 14 fret and then there's this one, and they're as close as two guitars can be because the top is the exact same piece of wood as the back and sides. And by the way, this top is Italian spruce, and it's sourced from the same place that they sourced the Stradivarius violins from.
So, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it's really, wow. it's really, I mean, the whole story is just pretty remarkable. I'm
that's
feeling
wild.
Very,
that's
very.
Well, has David Crosby played this guitar yet? Or
he
no?
hasn't seen it yet. He's going to be so jealous, man. He's going to have to go. He is. He's going to be totally jealous, and he's going to have to go buy one for sure.
So the first time you and I met, you were opening up for Tim Reynolds.
Yeah.
Mint.
And yes.
That was like maybe 10, 15 years ago, something like that.
It was long ago. I think it was before I lived here.
So. Yeah, it was definitely, you were in Seattle at the time, I think, right?
Yeah.
Seattle, right?
Either Seattle or Idaho, I'm not sure.
I think you were in Seattle, and then did you move to Idaho after Seattle?
I'm originally from Idaho, and then I went to Seattle in like 20. Oh man, it was a long time ago. I was there in 2005, 2006. I lived there for 2 years. I don't think it was that long ago that we met. I think we met around 2010 or 11. Something.
Oh no, because I know that we
was it a long time. Was it even
we opened early? I opened up for Tim in 2006.
Oh, okay.
And I opened for Dave Matthews in 2007, and you had opened up for him, I want to say 2005. I'm almost sure it was 2005. And I think you've done a couple tours with him, right? You've done
I did a lot. Maybe? I've done more with Tim than almost anybody. I did a lot of stuff, like between 2003 and 2007, you know. Yeah.
I remember you telling me the story how you met. How did you meet? How did you go backstage? Or I think you were playing for his wife or something, and she was like...
That's how we got to actually like play together, because it was really interesting. But I'm really shy, especially when I was younger. I was just really shy to kind of approach people in a certain way. And he was one of my heroes. So I was just always like, oh my God, wow. You know? And basically I played with him a number of times and I always wanted to like say, hey dude, let's play one of your songs. But I just didn't really know how to approach that, as funny as it sounds. But long story short, I ended up in Boulder, Colorado for another show. I went to see him and I think someone said, hey, you know, one of Tim's songs, play it for his wife at the time. And I said, yeah, sure. And I played it for her. She's like, oh my God, has Tim heard this? And I was like, I don't know. She's like, you got to play that for Tim. And I played for him. She's like, you need to get him up there, Tim. You need to play this together. And that's how it happened.
That is crazy. Yeah. What, she was just in the audience and you just like,
she was backstage. Like she was down, they have a backstage downstairs at this place, the Fox Theater in Boulder. And yeah, it was a life changer because that was just a dream come true. You know, I was like, oh my God, we played You Are My Sanity. You know that song.
Yeah. I love that song. It's so great. Yeah. I've seen you play it with him.
Yeah.
And you guys just did a video of it, right? Didn't you guys?
Yeah, we did. We did a video this year. It was pretty cool. You know,
awesome. And you basically toured with him. I think you opened for him like, I want to say three years, something like that, all over the country, right? Did you do any international touring or did you just do?
Yeah, we never did anything international. I mean, that would be fun, but we went to New York and we did.
That's my bulldog saying hello.
Oh, nice.
Otis, I'm in an interview, buddy.
I saw that door open. I was like, dude.
You're like, what?
You got a ghost back there, man.
Dude, he comes in every interview. He comes in. It's the funniest thing. And then he just moves out and he goes his own way.
I love that. Awesome. Got to have the dog around. Yeah, but anyway, you know, we've done a bunch of stuff throughout the U.S. And he's been really kind. His road manager's a friend of mine named Fluffy. Is his real name, Fluffy Centner, and he's always been really supportive, you know. And we also had band tours together, which was really fun because I had a three piece awesome. And he had a three piece, and they would let us use their gear, and you know, we never had to move anything. You know how it is, like if you have an opener or something, everybody's just like, don't touch our stuff, you know.
Right.
If you can fit into their world, then you're good. So. Yeah, so we had a little fun. Those guys are hilarious. I don't know if you've seen TR3, but
I haven't, man. I've been wanting to see them, but they, you know, anytime he's played in LA, it's like rare, first of all. And second of all, I've either had a gig or I've been out of town. So, so I've never seen them, but I've known about them for like 20 years and just
never
seen them. And he's just a beast on any guitar, he's a beast.
Yeah.
And like, you know, he's just a madman on the guitar. Like yourself, dude. You really are. Like, you're very humble about it, which I love. But, dude, you are a beast on guitar. It's like, even Tim acknowledges it. Like, yo, that guy plays everything that I do better than I do.
Oh, yeah. He's sweet. Well, it's my passion, you know. I love to play. And so it's always fun to just keep going and try to just keep improving, you know? I mean, you know how it is. You're always looking for new inspirations and new tools to just push yourself forward, you know? So to me, it's not really about anything but just improving, getting better, trying to find really cool new things to try, you know, new styles and new techniques, all of that stuff. It all helps. To me, you know,
it's like there are times where I'm sure you go through this too. It's like sometimes I'm really excited that I'm learning a track that I've always wanted to play and know. Like right now for me, I'm learning a bunch of Steve Ray Vaughan stuff. And to me, I wish I could go tell my high school self, like, yo, man, you're going to be able to play these tunes one day, you know? So
to
me, there's that part where it's like, oh my God, I'm still like a little kid that's just got a guitar.
Yeah.
And then there's another side of the writing where it's like, if I write something really dope, I'm super excited about that. And then there's that other thing when it's just like soloing, like when you feel like your voice is becoming as a soloist, you know, as like a lead guitarist or something, where you feel like, oh man, I'm really on a level that I feel like I can start saying things in a way that I'm not hating everything I play, because that's also a part of it as you keep playing is like, you're just always trying to push to the next thing and you don't want to sound generic or regurgitating some bullshit that you're like, no, this is not what I wanted. You know, it's like finding that thing. So when you have those moments, it's like any one of those moments are great. But I find that you never have them all on the same day. They're like, one's on Monday, one's a week from, you know, Thursday, one's like 3 weeks from then. So, you know, it's part of it. But let's go way back for you.
Yeah.
When did you first pick up the guitar, and what was your moment of zen that made you want to learn the guitar?
Well, I'm pretty lucky because my dad's a singer-songwriter. You know, I don't know if you knew that or not, but my dad.
I read that in your bio, actually.
My dad is he's really, really amazing, you know. So I'm really lucky because I grew up around him. And, you know, part of the thing is that writing songs was never that foreign to me because I was like, oh, that's what my dad does, you know. And that, even just having that much of an influence, I think, you know, a lot of people. I'm sure you can relate when you start playing, you're emulating other bands and artists and stuff like that. That's part of the process. But for me, it was like I was emulating my dad, and that I had that as an influence really early on. But I picked up a guitar when I was like 9. My grandparents, his parents, were both opera singers.
Opera singers. I know. I was going to ask you about that because that's what I studied in school, man. So
did you really? Wow.
Yeah. Were they living in the U.S. or were they living in Europe?
No, they're born in Idaho. My dad's parents, and they were studying with another guy that was actually Italian, which is so funny because that's not the Italian side of the family. That's my mom's side. But they were learning, you know, because all you studied opera, it's all in Italian, you know, all operas in Italian.
Well, some of it's in German. Only the good stuff's in Italian.
That's true. That's
true. Mozart operas are in German, but all the good stuff, like Puccini, man.
Oh yeah.
Donizetti, all that stuff, all the best stuff is in Italian.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, so my dad grew up, and my grandmother was teaching vocal lessons, and he was like in his bassinet next to her, so all day he was hearing oh, 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 you know, doing all that. And then my grandfather, her husband, my grandfather, my dad's dad, was like a serious baritone, you know, and so she would accompany him, and he would sing opera. So it was nuts. And anyway, so being around my dad, I started playing piano, or I started taking piano lessons from my grandma when I was like 5. And, you know, of course I thought that was fun, but man, when I saw the guitar and I started getting interested in it, I was like, dude, this is awesome. Yeah. You know,
the guitar, did you start on electric?
I started opening my dad's case for his acoustic. And I just started playing around on there. And then my first guitar was like this really shitty student model nylon string, like the 3/4 size piece of junk, you know.
And did you learn classical first, or did you learn like something?
No, I started learning my dad's songs. I just really loved his music and started learning those. And then I started, you know, what was really popular, I think it was when I was 9 or 10, maybe like a year later, was Eric Clapton's Unplugged album. I started learning
my favorites. Still one of my all-time favorite live records.
Ever. Oh yeah, it's one of the best for sure.
When did you know that you wanted to be a songwriter? Because I mean, 9 years old, you're probably thumbing around and you think it's cool, but then you get into high school, and are you still that dedicated in high school, or were you just like
high school's where it really happened? Because I played, and I just played for fun, but I mean, I was kind of a loner in school because I grew up in this Mormon town. Everybody was Mormon, and except for us. And I mean, non-Mormons were pretty rare. So my dad moved into this house. My parents were divorced. My dad moved into a house that was really close to the high school. And at like every lunch break, I was just like, I'm going to go home, and I would go eat lunch, and then I'd play guitar. And I was just like really into it and just really dedicated. And then I met a drummer. And we started playing, and that's when it hit. It was just like, okay, I'm a musician. This is what I need to do. And, you know, just
start a band. Start a band in high school?
Yeah, a duo. Me and this drummer. It was just the two of us.
You were the White Stripes before the White Stripes.
Yeah, that's right, man. That's right. So it was amazing. It was really amazing. And just one of those things where I'm sure you can relate, but do you remember when you're first playing and you're just like, oh, my God,
it was like electricity in my
brain. Yeah. Yeah, and you're just smiling the whole time. You're just like, I can't believe this is happening. Yes. And also,
you know, I still have that feeling, man. It's really weird. Yeah. I just started a power trio, and with new guys, and it was like starting a band all over again, except we're all at a level. And man, I've had that same feeling, like giddy as shit. And I still get that feeling, and I love those moments because, you know, as the life of a musician, you really have to fight for those moments. After the first time, you have to fight for those moments to keep happening.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very tough to keep a consistent flow of inspiration. Let's put it that way.
Right.
For sure. But yeah, so I mean, this drummer was amazing, and I just from then on, it was like I was, you know, all through high school, and I'm sure we probably have the same or some of the same influences because I see your Hendrix posters back there. But in high school, I was like really into Hendrix, really into Stevie Ray Vaughan, and then also into this guy that came into my town just really serendipitously, but it must have been meant to be. His name was Billy McLaughlin, two-handed tapper, you know. Played like, you know, like, you know, that style, which is so cool. And, you know, I saw him for the first time and I was just like, shit, I have to do that. So cool. So just all these interesting influences. You remember the Spin Doctors?
Love them.
I mean, they were like, it was like Spin Doctors, Blues Traveler, Dave Matthews, all those people that were actually on the Horde Festival.
That was the first concert that changed my life.
Really? Who did you see?
It was Rusted Root, Lenny Kravitz, Dave Matthews Band, Blues Traveler.
That's what the same one I saw.
And I just remember being like, oh my God, whatever this is what I want my life to be. Dude,
that's amazing. That's exactly the same show that I saw. Same lineup and everything.
That's crazy. And
that was like 1996, probably.
Yes. Yeah. Did you graduate high school around then?
I was a couple years later than that. 98 was my class.
I was 96, and it was the summer of that year. So it was like right before I was going to music school, and I was studying opera in school. And that concert just changed it. It changed everything. I was like, I got to learn guitar someday. I started so late. So did you tour with this high school band, or did you just start pursuing?
We started doing like little regional tours. You know, we were going up to like where I'm from, it's Eastern Idaho, so it's close to Salt Lake. It's close to Wyoming. We started going to like Jackson, Wyoming, doing some stuff,
awesome.
Playing around. We weren't in Boise. We ended up going to Boise, which is the only real city in Idaho, but it ended up going to Boise for a number of dates and stuff like that. Then we ended up moving to Boise. Everybody did, like, because where I grew up is just a little tiny town. And I moved there to go to school, and then my original drummer moved there, and then actually that band that I had with him got signed, which is crazy.
I saw that on your bio. You signed to MCA, right?
Yes. And that was just nuts because we were in Idaho. But, dude, music at that time was so different, man. It was just so cool because none of this bullshit existed anymore.
Right.
People were much more present, and when they were present, you could have their attention, and music was the bomb, you know? And so when we were out playing, it didn't take long for us to build this following, and we were getting from like 500 to 1,000 people at every show. And
that's crazy.
It was insane. I mean, if you could do that now, you'd be a superstar, you know?
Right.
And just on the strength of that, we actually got signed. A couple A&R people flew out to see us, like from two different labels, which was crazy. But yeah, man.
And then what happened? Did you guys do a record together? And then
we did one record on MCA that came out. It's Marcus Eaton and the Lobby was the band. And the album came out, and you know, it's one of those things where the promotion was definitely not happening. You know, we had just a moron publicist, and if he's watching, you suck at your job. Hopefully he's not a publicist anymore. Terrible, man. Terrible, terrible publicist. So they couldn't get it anywhere. You know, they couldn't get, they supposedly they were just like, yeah, we spent $90,000 on a radio film thing. It never did anything, but you know, that's part of the process, you know. And
were you able to tour or anything like that for off the record?
We had a really good booking agent. That's the one thing that we got. And so we started touring more like in a bigger circle, and Colorado became like a big hub for us, which was the shit because that's where like DMB, Blues Travel, all of those guys, they had a home base basically in Boulder. Boulder was a big scene, you know? So we started playing the Fox Theater, which is where they played. And we started building this following, but our first tour was Victor Wooten. We opened for Victor Wooten, which was awesome, man.
Awesome.
Yeah, two shows with him. And then we did like a sideshow thing at Red Rocks. It was up on the top with
what? Oh, I know the side stage up there. Yeah,
with Sheryl Crow, which was really cool. But you know, I mean, it's not the main stage. It's something totally different. But it was still cool.
Still part of it.
Yeah, we played a really cool show at the Fillmore in Denver. Huge show with Guster. And we opened for Train in Seattle and Portland. Those were two of the best shows ever.
And then what happened? They just didn't capitalize on that kind of progress?
We did really well as a band, you know, like it was really building momentum, but they lost their deal. They didn't have any money to do a second record. They missed the opportunity to promote the first one. We had terrible management, and then the band just, you know, the other guys were just, you know, it was that time of your life where you're just so assured of yourself, you know, and the other guys were, they were just kind of like, I don't know, the drummer in particular, he was just really into like, dude, I could be getting paid so much more money to do other things, because he was just really egocentric.
Right.
20 whatever years old, you know, and he's just like, I'm done. I quit. He really quit because he just wanted to go make more money with other bands, but he could have worked that out, you know, if he had like a little bit more experience and intelligence, you know. So he quit, and then it just kind of fell apart from there. You know, it's unfortunate because they're really, really amazing musicians, really talented. They're still great, you know, still doing great stuff, but nonetheless. Well,
you know, it's like that's like your first welcome to the music industry kind of
moment. Yeah. Well, we did. We had other things too, man. Our management broke up in the middle of our first recording, and one of the managers took our master tapes. So we recorded a whole album that was stolen by the manager here in LA. We came down here, flew down, did the album. He stole the master tapes. We couldn't get him back. And he tried to blackmail us, and he was like, dude, I'll be your manager if you pay me this much, kick the other guy out, and then you can have your tapes back. We're like, why would we do that if we can just re-record the album, you know? So we ended up re-recording it and releasing it. Yeah, so it was pretty intense, but, you know, good education.
Right.
I can't believe I'm still, you know, like, I'm surprised my hair is not just completely white. You've seen that meme. You've seen that meme, right? It's like, music, this isn't hard at all. And it shows a guy that's like geriatric, and it's like, Marcus, 27 years old.
it's so weird. It like, chews artists up and spits us out just to, you know, make things work for the labels. It's unfortunate that it works like that, but what needs to happen is more music people need to be in those powerful positions. And most music people don't want to run that stuff. And I understand both sides, but it's also like, you know, how much longer can this run like this? It's just ridiculous.
It's just become so corporatized where it's not about making something beautiful and unique and artistic. It's about how much can you sell? And that's not a sustainable thing to me. I don't think, you know, I mean,
You go solo and start doing the acoustic thing and start building your brand as a songwriter?
That was kind of when my band broke up. It was like 2004. And I just, of course, I was really bummed out. I mean, I love my band and I loved being part of a group. I never really imagined myself as a solo. You know, honestly, I was just like, God, this sucks. I really wanted to play in a band, but serendipitously, I started looping really early on. Like, I got the first looper, I think it was 2002. And I was looping with
Line 6 pedal.
No, it was the Line 6 was out, but that only had 15 seconds. And then Boss came out with the RC20. And it was
the loop station.
And I'll never forget, actually, because Victor Wooten came through Boise. And he did a little tiny clinic. There were like 10 people there. And I took that. And that completely changed my life. But he borrowed one of those from the store where I ended up working, this place called Old Boise Guitar. And he's like, hey, can I use that? He plugged it in. I was like, oh, my God, dude, that's my dream come true. I didn't even know it was being made until that moment. So immediately I bought one. And I was like, this is so cool. So with my band, I was sampling my rhythm so that I could play, because I'm a, you know, really strong rhythm player. And when it was dropping out, I was the only chordal instrument. So I was like, oh, I can just sample some, you know, rhythm work and then solo over it. So after that, I just kind of started adapting this live solo show. And And then eventually it became like a really powerful thing where people were like, wow, you know, I love the band, but I really love your solo thing. And
yeah,
it just was, it was one of those forced, you know, what would you call that? Forced evolution, basically, you know?
And what did you, so the record I remember getting was the one with Fiona on it. Was that when you started doing the solo thing?
I think if you have one with Fiona on it, if you either have the first band album that had Fiona, yeah, or you, okay, that's probably what you have. And I was still kind of selling those, even though I was playing solo. And then I had a live album briefly that kind of disappeared, which is good, but it was kind of a temporary thing. I had opened solo for Derek Trucks.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was
the Derek Trucks band or what?
It was the Derek Trucks band. Yes, before Tedeschi Trucks, you know. And yeah, so I opened for him and I recorded the show live, and then it became like a little 5-song EP that I had with me for a while. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Dude, you had all these like run-ins.
Yeah.
So many big bands and so many, and you continue to do it, but it just is a statement to your musical integrity. It's like,
thanks,
music's,
man,
not giving up on you because it keeps putting you in these good little situations where you're around the artists and playing with them and able to kind of like catapult yourself to another level every time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really fortunate. I mean, I it's funny cause like, I like doing interviews like this because some, you know, obviously we all get frustrated and sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, I have done that, you know, and you forget, but it's just, we're always moving towards something, you know? So, I mean, I think it's good to reflect on the past and be grateful for it, but then also at the same time, it's good to just have a target, you know, and keep moving forward. But, you know, I mean, we're fortunate to live in a time where we can interact with people in a different way, you know?
Yeah,
and at the same time, it's not an advantage too. It's both, it's very paradoxical right now. You know, we have access to people, but we have too much access to them in a way because it takes a lot of the mystery away. And
well, it's also the market's super saturated. So people being able to decide between good and bad is getting less and less. Like the music education is being taken out of schools. There's so many factors where people don't know simple things about music that the generation before us is like, oh my God, this is Miles Davis. How do you not know who this is? So it just
I mean, that's another reason that I'm so in love with like Italy and Europe in general. Just I've been really lucky to play there because people have a completely different appreciation of music.
They have
more history. They know more about American music than anybody knows here, you know.
That's
like I had an Italian girlfriend and it was like she knew all about what was going on in the UK and what was going on here at certain time periods. And I was like, God, she knows more about music than I learned when I growing up, you know. It's just they have a different appreciation for it, you know. So when you play there, it's a big deal. It's not like, oh, that's cool, yeah, everyone does that, you know. It's a different vibe.
Let's play something from one of your studio tracks. Which one would you want to play?
Play Shadow of a Bird. That's, I can tell you a little background of that. So that song, that's a cool story. I'll give you a really quick setup for it. I was in Italy touring around. And I had a label release my album over there. And I did a 5-week tour solo. And I was pretty, you know, afraid. I mean, nervous in a good way. But I was just like, oh, my God, I've never done this. And I was all by myself, you know, no sound person, just going with my guitar, pedals, and my bags, riding the trains all over to places that I've never been before, you know. So it was like a full-on adventure trip. So I got back and I had like a week in Rome and I found this really beautiful spot right in the center of Rome. And I was riding the train into the center from my friend's house and it's called Piazza Venezia. And there's a place, Palazzo Venezia, which is the Palace of Venice or Venus. It's the same. And in the center, there's this really quiet spot with this fountain. So I was walking through to my favorite cafe and I was like, God, this would be a great place to write a song. So I took my guitar down there. And it was like one of those moments where I was actually working on another song and this one just sort of magically appeared. And it's called Shadow of a Bird. So that's the song. Yeah.
Here's Marcus Eaton with Shadow of a Bird.
The sun, chariot of the race. Half light, the moon is always knowing where the sun is going when she shows her face. Flying takes more than wings, courage to cut the strings and go.
You know what? It's so funny because I was like thinking about your music the other day, and I was like, there's somebody that I love that I can't place who Marcus's music sounds like. Did you ever listen to Duncan Sheik?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Dude, that record Daylight is like one of my favorite records. And man, your music has some like Sting-isms and some Duncan Sheik-isms and then a sound that nobody else has, you know, that's very kind of like early 2000s. Like, it's got that, you know, I love that music that came out in that time period. You have Vertical Horizon, you have Dave Matthews Band, you have all these great like pop rock bands, John Mayer, and you're like reminiscent of all of them, which is really great. You can tell your influences, but
I know, thanks, man.
That song especially, when I was listening to it earlier, I was like, man, I know this sounds like somebody that I've heard before, but I can't place it. And just now I was like, Duncan Sheik Daylight, that record.
Yeah, dude, that's a great album. The other thing that I get sometimes, which I think is a really big compliment, but Seal, you know, Seal. Oh, yeah. Seal's amazing. So,
dude, the drummer in this power trio I'm starting is Seal's drummer.
Oh, wow.
Dude, he's wicked. He's wicked. And he's just, like, I keep sending him, like, Henrik songs or Stevie Ray Vaughan songs. And it's just like, Seal is, like, one of my favorite singer-songwriters.
Yeah, Seal's great.
Did you ever collaborate with Seal or anything? I saw something on your bio that was like...
I had one really funny gig one night, which was I met Seal's brother, who's a friend of mine, through another whole different thing. But he just called me and said, hey, man, what are you doing this night? And I said, well, I'm free. He's like, yeah, we're doing this benefit. He's like, then he called me back. Hey, dude, can you learn Crazy, my brother's song? I was like, yeah, of course. I know that song. He's like, well, dude, you're going to play it with him at this benefit. And I was like, oh, okay. I just thought, for some reason, I was like, oh, this will never happen. You know, just, you know how it is in music. It doesn't happen. So I said, oh, all right. Yeah, sure. I'll learn it. So I did. And then he called me back and he's like, dude, I think Flea's going to play bass with you guys. And I was like, no way. And it happened. It happened. He called me up. I showed up. We played this benefit. It was me and Flea and Seal and this other drummer. And I was like, holy shit, dude. It was amazing. Crazy, it was amazing. So, yeah.
You sure it wasn't a dream? Are you sure it really happened? No, I'm just kidding.
There's a photo. There's actually a photo to prove it. So
that's amazing. No, let me ask you, like, you started playing with David Crosby. You played on his last record and you've been touring with him forever. How did that come about, and what was that experience like? Just for you as a songwriter, I'm sure your dad was probably geeking out about it too.
Yeah.
From here it is.
Well, that happened. I mean, actually, there was a guy that I met when I was playing with Tim Reynolds. And I met him in 2006, I think, in Aspen. And he was one of the only people at the show. It was a really empty show, actually. And it just was because it was, I think it was winter time, from what I remember. And it just, you know, Aspen's, it just depends on the night, you know.
Right.
So he came up and he's like, hey, are you playing with Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds at the Santa Barbara Bowl? And I said, no, I mean, I'd love to be on that show. And he's like, well, let me see what I can do. I'm on the board there. And I just, you know how it is in music. Right. You're just like, this person's probably full of shit.
Right, right.
I said, oh, well, that would be great. I said, well, you know, if that happens, here's my email. So I gave him my email. He bought an album. He loved the show. And man, I couldn't believe it. He emailed me and he's like, hey, I tried to get you on this show, but I couldn't be on there because of a curfew thing. And I was just like, oh my, I can't believe this, you know? So his girlfriend said, you know, we'd love you to come play our Christmas party. So I flew back to play their Christmas party. It was in Omaha, Nebraska. And as it turns out, he had formed a label. He and his brother co-founded Gateway Computers, and he formed a label that put out all of Crosby's new music. And wow. He was like, you know, I love your music, and I think David Crosby would really like it. And I was like, really? So he sent him an email, and I started getting these emails from Crosby. He's like, wow, this is really good. I really like this. And then, like, the next email would be like, wow, this guy's a great guitarist. And I was just getting these funny responses, and I go to my mom. I'm like, you know who emailed me today? And she's like, no. I said, David Crosby. She's like, what? Crosby, Stills and Nash, Crosby? David Crosby? I said, yeah. She goes, that was my favorite album in college. Like, that's all I listened to. And I was like, well, yeah, he emailed me today. And next thing I know, you know, he put us together. We had dinner here in Santa Monica. And we totally hit it off. Like, just we started talking about what we were listening to. And it was like, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm really into this new girl, Esperanza's Falling. And I was like, oh, I love that album, you know. So we just kind of hit it off. And he's like, here, take my number. Give me a call. I was like, okay, you know. And I just thought, well, you know, maybe he's a good connection for, you know, maybe I can ask him about management or something, because that's what I was looking for at the time. And next thing I know, he just said, well, we ought to get together and try to play. I'd love to just hear your stuff and hear you in person. So we arranged this time, and he forgot about it. Actually, when I was down here, we just kind of like drove past each other on the road. I was on the way up to Santa Barbara. He was on his way down, but he came through Boise And I called him and I said, hey, you're coming through Boise and I'd love to get together. So we finally got together and I played for him and he just totally flipped. He totally flipped. And he's like, you got to play for my son. He called his son, James, you got to come over to the hotel room. Come to my room right now. So I played for him. And then like since then, he was just my best friend. He's just like, dude, we got to do something. You know, I'm going to Europe. I'm going to open for Paul McCartney. I was like, oh, okay, that guy. So he's going over there with CSN to open for McCartney. He called, and when he got back, he was like, hey, sent me this email. I was wondering if you'd be interested in playing on my new album.
And, you're like,
and
yes.
And I didn't even say anything to anybody because I was like, this is going to fall through for sure. And
right,
I just
didn't,
I didn't even want to jinx it, you know. So it was like October 31st of 2009. I think I went in there. That was the first date. I just remember because it was Halloween. And yeah. And then when I was in the studio, I called Mom, Dad, that's where I'm at. You know? Yeah. So it was crazy. It was crazy. So we played together. We did that album. It took 3 years. Put the album out.
3 years to do the record?
Yeah. Because they were, you know, he was always on tour with CSN and
right.
It was like a side project. So we finished it up, which seems like it took forever because it did. And the album came out and then we went out toured to promote it and played on Fallon. That was the highlight for me. We got to play on Fallon and it was like, yes, it was really, really fun. Really cool. So, yeah. And then actually subsequently, I mean, we played together for about 6 years, but only really got to do that one tour, which meant that there were 5 nights here at the Troubadour. That was a highlight of the tour. That was amazing. 5 nights in LA at the Troubadour where it all pretty much started, you know.
Right. That's the Laurel Canyon movement right there.
Yes. Yes. So that was really cool. But the thing that happened was that I introduced him to my brother. And I don't know if you know this because
I read in your bio that he did a documentary on him, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So this spun off and he did this documentary, which was amazingly successful. I mean, critically acclaimed, got a Grammy nomination. My brother directed it. Cameron Crowe produced it. So,
wow. Yeah.
So he just, man, he hit the ball out of the park and yeah, he did an amazing job. And then he hired me, my brother hired me to score the film. So it came back full circle. And, you know, at first I was like, oh, I'm going to be involved in the film musically, but that didn't happen because Crosby just kind of like, was like, ah, I'm going to do something different. Got a different band, different people, different personnel, the whole thing. Yeah, so it was just a really interesting transition, and you know, it was great to work on it, especially with my brother, and also you know, Snarky Puppy.
Yeah,
they are okay. Well, their pianist's name is Bill Lawrence, and he and I collaborated on this score together, and he's incredible, man. He's one of my favorite musicians.
All those cats are just like insane.
Yeah.
You know what I love about your writing, though? It's like I meant to tell you this after the first song. You have so much music in you, and yet you are able to make it accessible for people.
Oh, thanks, man.
You do cool things that musicians will go, yeah, man, that was cool. But you also make it accessible for the non-musician that's listening, and they can go, yeah. Oh, that's cool. That sounds good. Like, what's your process as far as, like, when you're creating? Are you thinking, I want to make this accessible. I want to make something that I want to hear. What's your kind of process, your creative process?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, I think that you can get lost in your musicianship, you know, because it's like, it's fun to play. I love to play guitar.
Right.
And of course, like, yeah, solos are great, you know, but there comes a point where you just, you know, you have maturity and you just go, okay, well, what is this? What am I trying to say? And I was in a band and I had this, you know, my trio, and I had this incredible drummer, you know, just nuts. And we were all just playing like really, it was not all technical stuff, but what happened was people were so focused on the technical ability. It was just like, oh my God, dude, your drummer's playing so fast, you know? And I just remember like after a while, I was like, you know, this is not what I want to do. Like, I'm not here to go to solve a math problem for somebody. And they go, dude, the way you solved that problem was so amazing. You know, what I really want is I want it to touch them here.
Right.
And I was writing songs that were touching people here, but when we put them in the band format, it wasn't coming across that way. Yeah, it was just like, you know, double bass, and that doesn't do anything for me, you know. And it's, you can use that as a tool. I mean, you can use it to make more emotion happen. You know, that's really what it's for. I mean, really, if you think about it.
Well, it's funny because it's like, that's why I keep going back to Jimi Hendrix. Like, I'm going through this humongous resurgence of Hendrix, learning a lot of his tunes, learning a lot of Stevie Ray Vaughan's tunes. And I'm like, dude, these guys did exactly what it is that you want to do.
Yes.
With facility, creativity, artistic expression, songwriting, like making a statement with the blues, whatever it is, and making a hybrid so that it's like something different too. I mean, it's weird because it's like what you said, it can be so technical but not artistic, or it could be one or the other and not enough. All the combinations of things that you want to put in there. So
yeah. And the thing is,
you have this right recipe though. That's like,
thank you. Well, I mean, the other thing is I really don't, you know, I reference other things every once in a while, like for certain elements, but I'm really trying to stay true to my thing, my authenticity, because man, nobody's doing that. I just think it's so important. People that we love, everybody that you mentioned is unique. And I don't think that formula songs are the way to go. And I don't, I mean, there's things that I listen to and I go, that's like musical, it's musical addiction in a way. It's like, wow, that's really a catchy melody, but you listen to it twice and then you don't want to hear it again, you know, because it doesn't lead you somewhere. And the ultimate thing is like, you want to take somebody on a journey, but you want to connect with them emotionally. So during the writing process and the recording process, I mean, if anything, I'm kind of trying to getting in the way of anything that's communicating that emotion. I mean, you know, the vocals are the most important thing. That's the bottom line. And luckily, actually now I have a really, really, really good mixer. And I wish I would have found him when I was like 25, you know, because God, he mixes so well. He puts the vocal in the perfect spot. And if anything, I think my music has actually gotten simpler, because there was a moment, I have quite a few albums now, but I have this album called Story of Now. And there were these songs on there that were like 7 minutes long and, you know, a bunch of different chord changes and stuff. They're really cool. But yeah, I didn't have a producer. You know, I didn't have somebody to come in and be like, God, that's a great idea. Let's do this. Let's simplify that. Change a few bass notes. And then you have something even more presentable and accessible. Right. But I've just been learning that as I go. And I'm sure it's the same for you, where, you know,
I'm constantly trying to fight that.
Yeah. But the person that you're looking for is you, you know, you're not going to find a producer that's going to be like, bro, I've done all the Rolling Stones albums and I know exactly what to do with you. Like, those guys, they don't exist anymore. And if they did, they're not interested in what we're doing, you know? Right. So you have to become that person for yourself, and you just kind of have to intuitively follow your instincts and then also just think about it emotionally instead of technically, you know?
Well, let's play something else real quick. What do you want to play next?
Let's play, well, I put the song Handed Down in there. So actually, if I'm going to play one live, which I should, because I want you to hear this guitar. So let's play Obvious, which is my new, brand new single.
Here's Obvious.
If only this could mean something, then something could be real. Then I could sail beyond all the winds that keep me still. Either trapped by the sirens or the waves that push us back inside some holding pattern foretold by the zodiac. Silent order of everything, just the rise and fall of your breathing. How can you be so full of doubt when it's obvious things are working out? When it's obvious things are working out, if only tension peaceful. The beats would endure. Smile never felt so painful as one that is unsure. Alone into the future, with time moving so swift, can't see what lies ahead now. Mountain hidden in the mist. Silent dawn of everything. Just the rise and fall of your breathing. How can you be so full of doubt when it's obvious are working out? Well, it's obvious things are working out. The silence cannot reach the distant shore. If my eyes should ever gaze upon the ones they're looking for, but meanwhile, obvious things are working out. In the trinity of the sky, where the sun takes his bow, and as we're getting closer, every moment becomes now. Silent order of everything. Just the rise and fall of your breathing. How can you be so full of doubt? Obvious things are working out. Yeah. When it's obvious things are working out.
So great, man. So great. Find Marcus's music at marcuseaton.com. Marcus, what are you going to play us out with?
I'm going to play you a song called Fiona. This is kind of like an old classic, if you will.
I was hoping you were going to play this song, so it's awesome.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned this earlier. Actually, I recorded this for my new album, actually.
It's such a great song. It's actually my favorite song of yours, man. It's
really cool. Thank you. Here we go. You ready?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
Across the ocean, by the sea, unsurpassed beauty named Fiona flows like water, rides our ocean blue. Never dreamt of the day when she break my heart. Now I dance across the water, cause she brightens up my day. I have nothing left to offer, all my time slips away. I'll treat you just like a queen. Feel your eyes, cause they're glamorous. First time I saw her, she danced across the stage. Right into my heart, I said, I won't let her go. brown beauty. We dance, we are so free. Fell in love with Fiona. She fell in love with me. Now I dance across the water just to hear her voice. And I have nothing left to offer, but I'll always have the choice. I'll treat you just like a queen. Feel, open your eyes, cause they bless. Want to take you with me, and I'm leaving for. Please say don't go with me, I don't want to leave. Oh no, Fiona, tell me that I'm in love with you. Try to fight it. Dark, she waved goodbye. As my ship set sail, I felt my soul begin to die. Thought I'd never see her again. Till the day she came to me. She said, I love you so much. Sailed across the sea. She said, I've never loved another. And my heart began to rejoice. Then I remembered what I told her. She began to do my voice. So treat you just like a queen. Eyes, cause they never seen.
Marcus, we're going to have to collaborate on some music, dude. Long overdue, and let's hang in person soon.
Let's do it. I love it.
Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Sam, Hassan, and myself, and, of course, Marcus Eaton, check out his music at marcuseaton.com. We'll see you guys here next week. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.